I was diagnosed with colon cancer 6 months from graduating. I was responding to traumas in the ER 1 hour, and the next hour, I was being told I had to pull the ripcord. It was all over.
Einar Sawyer is a physician, cancer patient, and a digital health innovator at UCSF. She's got a 360-degree view of healthcare, and she's had a non-traditional path to practice.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
Welcome to Tectonics, the podcast that focuses on the people and passion and the intersection of technology and health. I'm Lisa Soonan, managing partner of Venture Valkyrie Consulting.
And I'm David Shaywitz, the chief medical officer of DNA Nexus. On today's Tectonics, we are joined by Dr. Einar Sawyer, an orthopedist at UCSF, where she helps lead frontline digital health innovation. She's also one of our very favorite people, and we're thrilled, absolutely thrilled, that she's a guest today on Tectonics. Welcome to the show, Einar.
Thank you. This is really a pleasure to be here.
Well, hopefully you'll feel that way at the end. Anyway, I've always been struck by the way you've combined deep technical sophistication with an incredible sense of empathy. When you think about innovation in digital health, what do you see as more limiting, technical chops or emotional connectivity?
Well, I think that when we try to provide healthcare in any medium, it's really limiting if you don't understand the person or the patient that you're trying to serve or help. So I think that would be, to me, number one. Regardless of the medium, whether it's digital or whether the person's right in front of you, I think it really matters that we take the time to understand who that individual is.
You have a pretty interesting journey to medicine that connects, I think, very much to that thought. My recollection is that your grandma was the start of that story.
Yeah, my grandmother was a fairly eccentric woman and I think ahead of her time a bit. She was an osteopath, as was her husband and her mother-in-law. So my grandmother, grandfather, and great-grandmother were all osteopaths. But she took off across the country with my father when he was just 2 years old and was just doing house calls and home doctoring till she made it to the desert in California, where they ended up spending a lot of their life. And she was someone who combined scientific rigor. I found many of her books with hours and hours of notes and independent study and a lifelong learning model for me. But in addition, she was always willing to entertain new ideas and new ways to help and heal, which was a real juxtaposition of two parts of her that I found really interesting, and I think it really made an impression on me.
Did she want you to go into medicine?
There wasn't any pressure about it. She loved it that I was fascinated with her anatomy books, and when we would visit her in the desert, she had all these treatment tables in her house and people would come out there for treatments and she had a wall of electrical plugs and she would create all these frequencies and
doses. Sounds very Dr. Frankenstein.
It was. For me, it was completely, it was Dr. Fascinating. It was really endlessly absorbing for me. So there wasn't a discussion of she thought I should do this or that, but she did say at times when she'd be showing me how to do a manipulation or some part of the body, she would say that you've really got a natural bent for this.
Did you always want to go into medicine?
Well, ironically, there were times where I thought I was actually going to be in theater. I was in theater all through my childhood. My mom was always in community theater, so we started on the stage really early. And I was a bit of a ham and class clown by the end of high school and got
this does not surprise me.
Drama award, not for high school drama that you typically think of, but the Bank America Drama Award. So bottom line is it did help me in
like
being
South
able.
Pacific?
What was your favorite role? What was the best role you ever did?
Yeah, we won some.
Oh my goodness. Well, these are really old, like Up the Down Staircase. And I was a no-neck monster in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Wow.
That was quite fun. Because we got to run around and just be awful. And that was natural for me. But it did help me articulate and learn how to deliver messages to people. And it also helped me understand, I think, more about empathy. How do you understand a person enough to take on a role?
How did all this theater stuff with your dad, who, as I recall, was in the military?
Well, what was really fun is my dad would design and build the sets. So I think I got my design and my building angle from him. So we would help build the sets. And I was also fascinated by that. And he didn't have enough boys, so he taught me how to use tools and build things, and including on our property, he and I built all the fences, et cetera. So it really helped me when I got to the OR and people said, how did you learn how to use these tools? So each of my parents and my grandmother in particular contributed parts of this whatever this composite person is.
From the theater, stage theater to the operating theater.
But it was a little bit of an indirect route, wasn't it?
It was. In the beginning in college, I was very interested in medicine, but the counselors at that time had said, your family has no money and you're a girl, so you should think of a nursing or physical therapy. I loved sports and I loved science, and I also had this mechanical aptitude where my mom had a fear that I was going to be a car mechanic. But I was able to pull that.
You would have made a lot more money, probably.
I think I would have. I would have enjoyed it, too. I think, though, that it was a natural thing for me then to find the field of physical therapy, which I enjoyed very much for the first 10 years of my professional life. And I found myself moving up in wanting to do more in healthcare, but ending up sort of on the career track of hospital management, which I realized was not for me.
Why is that?
We were sitting in meetings talking about other people doing all the work, and I really wanted to be on the front lines of doing the work. I wanted to do more and do more in healthcare, but I wasn't really sure of my path at that point.
So you've really taken this front line to, sort of almost to its logical conclusion. So take us there. So you're sitting, 10 years into professional development, doing extremely well, and then what happened? How did you make your next decisions?
Well, I wasn't clear on my path. First of all, I thought I was too old for medical school, so I decided to go into graduate school, and I entered at UC Davis a course of master's in physiology and exercise physiology as an emphasis, and sort of testing my brain, but I was TAing all the pre-med students, so I thought, I think I could still do this, and really was choosing between law school, med school, PhD, etc., and realized I didn't have the patience or the focus to get a PhD, and I really wanted to be more working with people. I couldn't tolerate all the words in a law book. I liked the pictures in the medical school book. So I just kept moving that direction and was fortunate to get into medical school at UC Davis.
Was it surprising to people that you made that switch?
I think at that point, people thought, you're all set. Why don't you buy a house? Because my choice was buy a house or go back to school. And I said, I just want to do more. I want more tricks in my shopping cart to help people. And I think I might have been a little bit afraid of getting bored. I wanted to be able to do more.
So can you take us back to your first day? If you remember when you were a med student and you're walking in, what did you feel that you were different from the other people in your class?
Oh, older. But I also...
Were you conscious of that?
I also felt like I was always like, someone's going to find out I don't really belong here. Because, these people are probably really, really, really smart. So is that sense carried with me for a while.
You practiced for a while, right? As a doctor? Or did you go straight
into
what you're doing now?
I went... I sorted my way through which specialty I wanted to be in. One of the interesting things about being in medical school was I did feel older, but our class was quite close. It was a small medical school. And I found that I had things to offer that the other students had certain things they brought and I brought experience from the
healthcare
world.
You knew how to use a saw, for instance.
Yeah, right. It was handy when we had to install the bench in the courtyard. But I also had been around patients and been around healthcare and was a little bit older, so had experienced some of life's challenges already. And so that I was able to share with them. And I think that was helpful. We don't learn anything about the allied health professions in medical school. So I was able to talk to them about what does a physical therapist do. And the other people on the healthcare team, I was able to show them that a team approach to healthcare is really quite valuable.
That's really interesting because often in training, it's one of the things some of the particular younger med students have trouble with and doctors in training is the concept of teams and the idea of working on a team. And I imagine that coming up the way that you've done, it sounds like that was sort of a sensibility you were able to bring to your colleagues.
I think so. I think it helped a lot. And it was also fun for me because at that point, med school had started taking more non-traditional students. And so we were also able to appreciate in each other differences. There were people coming from engineering and from other backgrounds or other undergraduate degrees. And so I was saying, I think team approach is great. And they were coming from different disciplines. And so that multidisciplinary or interprofessional mindset got reinforced for me there, and I've carried that on, hopefully, in my career.
You finished med school. You decided to go into ortho. You're going through it. You're chief resident. And then you described, at the 2012 Rock Health Innovation Summit, you described a really moving experience as sort of, a transition from physician to patient. Mm. Can you share some of that with us?
Yes, it was a real surprising moment in my life because I had been a vegetarian and a marathon runner and thought with my exercise physiology degree I could actually create the compressed morbidity model for myself and engineer my path in health. And I was diagnosed in my chief resident year when I was chief resident leading the orthotrauma service at Stanford. I was diagnosed with colon cancer 6 months from graduating. We had no family history of that, and of course my diet and activity didn't fit into the model. So I was a bit of an outlier age-wise, gender-wise, and lifestyle-wise.
So you were just shocked when you discovered it?
I was shocked. I was responding to traumas in the ER 1 hour, and the next hour I was being told I had to pull the ripcord. It was all over. That was the statement that was given to me. And I had had some symptoms and concerns, but kept dismissing them as something else. And so by the time I actually got there, I, in my head, knew. I had sat up in bed the night before and knew exactly what it was. But it was still an absolute shock to have cancer in the same sentence with my name. But I'm very, very grateful every day to be here because I don't know what dot on the plot I am. You know, when you look at this graphs, they're very intimidating. I've had metastatic cancer, and I'm just very fortunate to be here. But what it does is it makes me less patient about trying to get to better solutions, but it also informs the types of things I concentrate on. I think collaboration between providers is critical, and so it's challenging, it's difficult. And I was able to gather my records and run around the country, but many people should have access to that kind of a multidisciplinary team evaluation of their condition and make decisions off of that. So it's driven me to work with a colleague, Pierre Theodore, on building a virtual tumor board model or a multidisciplinary care model. And this is the type of thing that digital technology is allowing us to do. And I think ultimately we won't be talking about digital health. We'll be talking about health. This will be the medium that it's delivered in. We have the ability now to disseminate health to more people at lower cost and better health care.
Would you say at the end of the day it's going to be less the technology and more the willingness of people to share and communicate?
Well, I think, you know, we don't have societal consensus around data and the privacy and security issues. I think it's very important that we protect patients' security, privacy.
Absolutely.
Of their data. So I think that issue is going to keep changing. Younger generation might have less concerns about privacy. Ultimately, all of us can face discrimination in very subtle ways when people know things about our health. And unfortunately, that is the case. But more importantly, these are very individual choices about how much you share about your health care. And I think that we do have these tensions of free the data and the HIPAA fines, et cetera. I think we're going to work through them as a society. I don't think it should freeze us in our tracks as far as trying to advance along the path of digital health, but I think we should continue in a parallel discussion about how we manage data. I personally have a fairly radical idea that I've been expressing lately is we should create the highest bar of privacy and security and implement that all the way out through the consumer health and wellness technologies as well, because the plane of when it's protected health information and when it's not is getting so fuzzy and so spread that we shouldn't even worry about it. We should make it so that information can flow in and out of from well system to healthcare system, because we all as humans move back and forth through the system, and our information should be able to move with us. So there aren't clear distinctions anymore about what's PHI and what's not.
Interesting.
So just set the bar and put everything in that plane, and then the information can move freely.
Well, it's interesting because actually there's a pretty significant movement among entrepreneurs and lobbyists working for them in Washington to water down the security and HIPAA rules. They're trying to get those loosened because it makes it harder for entrepreneurs to build things. That's the story anyway. So it's an interesting tension to think about, you know, who should win that war, the clinicians, the patients, or the entrepreneurs, and where their interests differ.
And also what winning looks like. I mean, I can imagine a scenario where winning looks like being able to share data richly and leverage the sort of the wisdom of the community.
Well,
experts.
I definitely don't mean that we should restrict and silo data. That's not the direction I'm going. But I'm talking about when we're building technologies that involve patients or people, persons putting data in, that's very personal to them. I think unless we create environments where they feel safe doing that, we're actually going to have a harder time getting data from them that could be very critical. So
that's a great point.
I'm on the same, I see the same endpoint, I have the same eye on the prize, but I might be coming at it from a little different angle. I think technologically it's going to get easier and easier to build in the privacy and security standards all the way across. Not that things can't be hacked, but I think that we need to make those capabilities better understood by the technology developers and make it easier for them to do them. If you're talking about the fines for HIPAA, scaring people, etc., we probably do need to renegotiate how those things are addressed.
What is it like for a doctor to go through the medical system? You know, I got to believe it's a different experience than for the average person.
So in some ways, it's helpful. In other ways, it's really disabling because you can't stop your mind from running through the differential, from running through every patient that you've taken care of, and usually you're focusing on the unsuccessful ones. It's very challenging in that way. The other is, it's incredibly obvious that your power depends on which side of the white coat you're on. And I'm hoping we're changing that as we try to empower patients more and more. But that became very, very clear. So,
can you give an example of that? Like a moment where you sort of were particularly conscious of that power differential and experiencing it from the patient side?
And I don't mean it, you know, in my experience, it wasn't power in used in a bad way. But you are really...
your vulnerability?
You're very, very vulnerable. And your choices become more and more limited. Unfortunately for me, I understood a lot, and I also became a patient in my own hospital, which was a very difficult thing, as you can imagine. And there's a point at which you struggle so hard to keep engineering because you're used to directing things in that building. There comes a point where you have to understand that you can't be the expert in this, or this is what my experience was. I couldn't become an expert in the care of colon cancer patients, but I could become an expert in my experts. And so I developed this phrase of seek excellent care and heed their advice. Part of it's my personality, and part of it was I was trained to take responsibility for what was happening in the room, and yet I had to switch gears at some point and do my homework, but then turn it over.
So did your relationship with your doctor colleagues change when you were on the patient side of the white coat?
What was interesting was, and this is just human nature, they were in some ways afraid to come around me. Because it's just so hard. I mean, when we see our own colleagues in this predicament, we see ourselves there. And even though we know that when patients seem to be doing worse, many studies have shown that fewer people come by their bedside, even the professionals, we try hard to not let that happen, but when it's one of our own, it's that much harder.
Wow, that's really interesting. I mean, you'd think it'd be the opposite, right? When people
You'd
need
hope
you.
It would be. Right?
You'd hope it would
well,
be the opposite.
And
yeah.
I, you know, definitely I was surrounded by love and people that really cared about me. But I had great empathy for my colleagues that would come to visit me because they were so uncomfortable. And I did feel bad for them.
That's such an interesting thought, you know, that doctors uncomfortable with sick people, right? I mean, since that's by definition kind of who they chose to hang around with.
I didn't think of it as a bad thing, though. I think it showed how much they cared about me.
Mm-hmm.
It really did that they ached that badly. That's how I looked at it.
And then could you describe also my recollection from what you said at that Innovation Summit was that you took a very active approach to your care in terms of seeking out care both at your hospital and at other places. Can you describe how you went about that?
Well, I had at least, you know, the wherewithal to remember my great teachers at UC Davis. You know, this wasn't my field by then. I was 5 years into my orthopedic surgery training. So I did remember enough to know how to get back and search all I could about clinical trials and unfortunately, too much about the prognosis, et cetera. But by doing that, I had the wherewithal to understand and synthesize information, and I had the understanding that I was going to have to get my own records and search out my own experts. I had great care there. And they offered anything I wanted in terms of other opinions. But I did do a lot of work. At that time, email was brand new. And so I went around making lots of calls and found experts in different parts of the country and fortunately could gather the resources to fly to those experts. I was already under treatment, so I did the neoadjuvant course. So I was already pretty sick by the time I could get to Sloan Kettering and to Pennsylvania, and all of that was a struggle, but I was fortunate to be able to pull that together. Most people can't do that.
Here you are, obviously, alive.
Yes.
And healthy. And I kind of have two interesting questions, for me anyway. Does it make you think that all this healthy wellness, healthy eating stuff doesn't matter?
People have asked me that over and over. No, the way I looked at it was bad luck. You know, I think we're having mutations occur in our body all the time, and sometimes the guard dogs get them and sometimes they don't. And, you know, I obviously was living a life of great stress and not mm-hmm. sleeping much and on a steady diet at that point of graham crackers and coffee. And so in that window, I couldn't blame, you know, good lifestyle choices. But on the other hand, all my healthy lifestyle prepared what I think was really good substrate to fight the battle. Mm-hmm. And so I do believe that it really did matter, and I think it still does matter.
You know, as you sort of re-entered the doctor side of the coat, you know, as you put the coat back on, what was the biggest lesson you took from that experience?
Well, first of all, it wasn't that easy.
Okay.
There were, you know, I'll go into that if you wish, but
yeah, sure.
When I did transition to taking care of patients again, it actually wasn't just patients, it was people in the world. I looked at people so differently. Everybody, in my mind, is struggling with something. We all go through life trying to maintain dignity, so we often hide our struggles. I now look at each person as they're struggling with something, and whatever kindness or openness I can bring to them, I should. And especially if they're behaving badly, it should trigger in me more that they're struggling with something.
That's
such a good person.
We've spoken about this before, you and I, about how everybody has a story, right? And
exactly.
How it's such an interesting challenge when people come at you in a negative way to try to think about it and through the lens of their problem that they may be having, and that's why they're acting like a jerk or whatever it may be. But I think in the physician world, there's such a sort of premium on sort of the power position, having, you know, pretty strong ego, being somewhat in that God complex thing. And in a world today, we're all trying to talk about patient empathy and putting the patient in the middle and all this stuff. How does that change happen over time? You know, how do people, do they teach that in medical school now? How to be empathetic?
I think they have been for a long time. I think some people, if you've had challenges in uh-huh. life, you're naturally going to be more open to that. I have a hard time when I hear the like big stereotypes mm-hmm. about doctors, and maybe it's because I hang around with like-minded people, but most of my colleagues have been compassionate and tried to behave that way. The stresses of the system are really great.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes you would like to spend more time with a person and you are actually five people behind already.
Mm-hmm.
So I might be a little bit Pollyanna about that, but for the most part, I think med schools have been trying for a very long time to teach more about it. And actually it's more about selecting for those traits as well. And I do think that sometimes what happens is the pressure of the system changes an individual. You come in very altruistic. You want to help people. And the pressure of the system and the mechanics of it, et cetera, start changing how you're delivering care patient to patient. And it's hard to buck up against that. Mm-hmm. And we try.
So how does your sort of your experience and then really your view, I mean, what you're, you know, what you're talking about seems to me exactly how you really live, and how anyone who's interacted with you is just sort of struck by the incredible depth of your empathy, your compassion. How has that impacted your sort of future direction in general, and does that relate to your interest in digital health?
I think my evolution to digital health has been from several angles. One is, I think that even with digital health, we need to do a better job about understanding the person. And I'm saying now we're bringing more design thinking into innovation in healthcare, but I'm also trying to bring it more into patient care, in actually care delivery. So getting to know your patient better and using design thinking principles around that. So I think that the empathy piece is really important. I also think that it's always been my focus to try to empower people to take care of themselves, from a PT to an exercise physiologist to an orthopedist. No one leaves my office without a home program. So this medium we now have of digital health to not only inform people better, which is incredibly powerful, but to empower them to take better care of themselves through a variety of the tools that we're building right now.
Have you seen it working? Do you there's obviously so much hype, so much excitement about the potential of digital health. Do you feel like you're starting to see the point where it's beginning to impact people in the way that you envision?
Well, I still think we have a ways to go to get from the promise of digital health to the power or the empower of digital health like when that. You get to the individual. And I think it's going to require better understanding of not just giving technology to people to allow them to make better choices in self-management, but we need more behavioral sciences so we understand what will engage, sustain engagement, create a transition in behavior. So we need more pieces to the puzzle. I think we need much more interoperability. I know you've heard me say this, the ability to connect not just data, but information. So the data gets contextualized and gets to be actionable. And then we also really need a lot more evaluation. We need to create settings and studies and bring the scientific rigor to do these things work. Are they effective in care and cost?
Is there an example of a company you've seen who's, you know, sounded good but hasn't shown it yet, that, you know, people are excited about our technology, people are excited about, but if you really dig in, nobody's really proven anything, there's value there?
Well, I don't want to pick a company, but maybe an area.
Yeah.
So some of the wearables, so mm-hmm. self-monitoring of blood pressure, and even, you know, we've seen this with glucometers for a while, but there was a recent article about how in a pilot, self-monitoring and reporting of blood pressures, et cetera, didn't really change the condition, the chronic condition that was being monitored. So I think we are missing pieces of the puzzle, like I alluded mm-hmm. to earlier, and it's I say that the innovation has to happen in technology, personnel, and process. And if we skip a piece of that, we're less likely to succeed. So I think the home monitoring, we have a ways to go to show the benefits of that. I think the potential's there. We have to figure out how to put that nut together. And then I think the other is in the wearable space. So we've all seen the studies of where at least a third by 6 months aren't even wearing them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But that's okay. There are still some people who are benefiting, and we just have to figure out how to grow that population.
Sometimes I get a sense that that technology raises new issues instead of solving old problems. You know, that it just kind of adds to the pile of issues, like, for instance, compliance, instead of actually solving a problem in the digital health world.
Well, I do think that there are people who don't want to have another measure that they're not measuring up. And mm-hmm. I do think that, you know, gosh, we just don't want to add one more way that people can feel bad about themselves. So we have to figure out how we flip that mm-hmm. and give them the positive encouragement or whatever it is for that individual. How, you know, what's it going to take to move them to a healthier choice? And I think it, you know, there's some things we already know. Instant gratification instead of deferred gratification works better. Like, you're not going to have a heart attack in 10 years if you eat lettuce today instead of popcorn, you know, whatever. So we know that works. We also know that if you can get the information to them right at the moment that they're deciding something, and it's this phrase I use called point of choice, like we use point of care in mm-hmm. the medical world, but at point of choice, if we can suddenly give the right information and the right incentive, we have a better capability to
make
a
right
different
direction.
Choice. Exactly. Yeah. But we have to know what matters to them. They may not care about, you know, if they're going to be suffering with a peripheral neuropathy soon, but they may care if they're not going to see their grandchild get to a certain level in school, or they can't even text them because they can't feel the keyboard. So we have to figure out what matters to that individual.
Sort of like the idea of having people's pictures of loved ones on a refrigerator or something to prevent people from overeating.
And that won't work for everybody.
Right.
So I like the whole idea of trying to profile the individual and personalize the intervention.
So one of the unique opportunities you have is doing digital health in Silicon Valley. One of the things that it just seems like is there's such a, you hear these sort of very sort of broad brush critiques of medicine and how, oh, if only physicians would embrace technology more, medicine could be better. Medicine has to be disrupted, has to be reinvented, has to be replaced by algorithms, has to be, why can't people do medicine the way technology people do tech is sort of something that some folks talk about. Do you see doctors as more part of the solution or more part of the problem?
Boy, I love these questions because I like to refute some things that are out there. First of all, healthcare systems and doctors are getting a bad rap about being late adopters or resisting new things. And I just don't find that. Every patient I see and my colleagues see, we're constantly trying to create a new solution because that's a new problem, even though we've read the disease condition before. That's a new problem in that person. So we're always trying to create new solutions. We know healthcare is not optimal. We want to make it better. And so we're innovating constantly on the front lines. Now there are many people from the front lines who are saying, look, I understand the pain points and I witness them in my patients and I can conceptualize solutions so we can identify where they fit into the workflow or where the workflow needs to be disrupted itself. And then to be honest, we have to swim in our own soup. We are in healthcare. And so we want to make sure these things work for our patients and for the system itself. And then we're also steeped in the mindset that we should be evaluating anything that we're doing. And so we bring evaluation to the table. We can't do it alone. So I don't look at it as it should the changes be happening from healthcare or should they be happening from technology or some other field. We definitely need to partner across disciplines to make this happen.
One of the points that Jonathan Bush makes in, for example, you know, where does it hurt, is that the sort of the medical credo, first do no harm, has sort of led to this conservatism, this sort of reluctance to make changes. Is that something that you've seen at all?
I think that the influences on the system and the individual providers are complex, and they need to be understood in individual parts. So, for instance, one of our rules is we are patient advocates. So do no harm is really important. So I don't think you want me going into the OR and trying a new instrument or a new implant each time I go in. You'd like me to do something that I know I'm really good at and successful with a track record, et cetera. So it is our job to protect our patients from just experimenting. However, we do want to make things better. So where we can bring it in a safe way, we want to bring new things into healthcare as well as develop them. I also think that there are pressures from a financial standpoint on the system and on the providers in general that do dictate how care is delivered in certain circumstances. It would be a long explanation to get into that, but just to say that the influences and that guide whether a person brings something in quickly or not are great.
It's interesting to hear you talk about that because I think historically it's been considered, you know, day class A or at best and, you know, trashy tacky at worst that doctors engage in discussions about financials, that what things cost. Talk to patients about that. It should be separated. Doctors shouldn't talk about or care about cost. They should only make decisions about clinical stuff.
Well, I think, again, back to the altruistic place, I think all of us just want to take care of people and not have to worry about the costs. The truth is, it costs money. If we don't worry about the costs, we can't keep the wheels on the cart and we can't open the door for the next patient. This is what I learned after 10 years in private practice, which was never my vision, but it was a great learning experience. I didn't plan to be there initially, but I learned so much from that experience because I would have given all my care away for free if I didn't have a practice manager. Thank you, Rita, who actually insisted that we bill patients. I wouldn't have been there the next day to see the next patient because I had to pay rent and lights, et cetera, and malpractice. So I think we need more education in medical school about the complexities of healthcare delivery and how you create a sustainable model and what is the provider's role in that. Because we do play a role in it. Unwittingly, we might select a product to use in the operating room versus another product because we learned it in training and it's always worked for us. I haven't had any complications with that, so why would I change? And if someone says, well, you should change because it costs less, my first response is, does it work as well? So first of all, if we want to know it's going to work as well, and if it does, and we had the information about cost, we might make different choices. think that's been shown now, certainly in the pharmacy realm, where if you let a provider know how much things cost, and if they can find the evidence that they're equally effective, then they would choose one that's more sustainable, because we all know the healthcare delivery system is in a crisis. I think that one of the things that's interesting is we're starting to see more and more tools become available to us. Dr. Krina Zegaris at UCSF is building a technology right now to allow surgeons to know what the inventory was they used in a case and how much it cost and what are some comparable selections they could make that were equally effective. And just providing the information is really important. It doesn't mean that they are going to be told what to choose, et cetera, but it's a way of educating mm-hmm. people and making them aware. I personally know that more of the cost is being shifted to the patient. So it's not, no longer do you hear people saying, it doesn't matter, Blue Shield will pay for it. They know that their patients are really struggling to cover more and more of the cost. And I personally experienced this because I've had subsequent issues with cancer and have recently had more lab tests. I'm fine now, but I'm under close surveillance. Finding out how much a lab test costs that I order routinely has really makes me ask every day when I order things, and we try to do this all along, but if it's standard of care, we might order it reflexively. But now I'm starting to say, is that going to change my treatment decision on a very individual basis per each test? So I think physicians are learning more about their role in this. It's not price and finances isn't dictating what we do. That's not the number one point in the algorithm. It's, is this the right thing for my patient or not? But if there are alternatives that are as good, we're learning more about how to pay attention to that.
You know, last time we had our show, we had Lisa Mackey on, who was the CEO of PocketDoc, and she had told me that for medical reasons that she has this routine set of tests done every year, and that for the first time this year, and the tests routinely cost about $500 for her. And this year she went to Walgreens and got the Theranos version of this. It cost her $28 for the exact same set of tests. But of course, you're not in the doctor's office or the lab. I think it's just really interesting, sort of the different solutions that are coming around for patients on this.
I do think more alternatives are coming. I think we need to continue to do validation to make sure, because lab tests can vary a lot. Reference ranges, et cetera. So we need to keep mm-hmm. validating those tools. Theranos is great. I love moving things out to point of care, including diagnostics. But again, we need a lot of validation on those.
You referring to yourself as a provider and as your colleagues as providers. And I've seen a lot of drama about this term lately. That certain physicians think that's a demeaning term. Jordan. Others, yeah. Shout out to Jordan Schlein. Others who think it's obviously you do think it's a fine term. What do you think about that?
Well, I think the reason I do is because I don't want to leave out my extremely valuable, equally valuable colleagues of nurses, physical therapists, respiratory therapists, X-ray techs, people providing healthcare. So it's easy to just say doctors or physicians and. And maybe you mean other people, but to me it seems a bit exclusive.
So you really mean it as a term of inclusion,
yes.
To refer and is sort of a statement of your team orientation, versus whereas I think what some people don't like is it makes them feel more transactional. Oh, here's a provider. They feel like there's something in their training, in the whole learning to be a physician, that's sort of special or distinctive that they feel is sort of demeaned by the term provider.
I probably haven't kept up on the blogs recently then, because for me, I didn't know that was out there. I think I'm hoping I'm providing something when someone takes the time to come into my office and trust me and allow me this intimate interaction with them. I really hope I'm providing something of value. So that's, the term seems natural to me.
Yeah, your patients are so lucky to have you.
Well, I don't know. My sisters are probably going to call up and say, hey, she's not all that good a person.
So, you know, a last question, I think. You spend a lot of time advising technology companies, technology people about how to make their products and services more relevant. For all those tech people out there who really don't come from the healthcare world, what's the thing you need to say to them? What's the thing they need to hear from somebody that comes, you know, from not just from a medical world, but from a whole long family history of that? What's the lesson that they need to learn and the message they need to hear, the advice you have for them?
Well, I just got back from being at the Center for Design Research at University of Kansas, which was a great experience. And I just
I know you're not in Kansas anymore.
There's no place like home.
We did our whole life to say that.
Oh, my goodness. But you do have your ruby red slippers on.
That is true.
So what I saw was undergraduate design students in the Center for Design Research that Gregory Thomas has put together back there. It's phenomenal. And they were doing solutions for Bayer in the field of diabetes. And there's been this ongoing relationship he's created for this. And I saw 13 students present, undergraduates not from life sciences, who presented from a design technology and also from the clinical side. And it reminded me of what does it take when you step into a field where you know nothing? How do you go about that? So I would say if you're coming from the technology aspect and you didn't come through life sciences, get to know it, find your experts, get clinical input early and often. And when you're putting your concept up on the whiteboard is also the same time as you start your evaluation plan. And that evaluation needs to happen all the way across the arc of development, including the very beginning evaluation of know your audience. Who are you designing for? Who are the people that influence and will be impacted by what solution you're creating? And talk to each of them. See what you can learn.
So that really seems sort of like Steve Blank type, know your customer, have some feel for it, as well as sort of IDEO influence.
It is a blend.
Feel for design.
I fully agree. The human-centered design blended with the Lean Launchpad methodology. But also, I think it's very simple. It's empathy. It's know your audience.
It's so interesting because, like you were saying, when we were talking with Lisa on our previous podcast, her number one theme was that if she could tell engineers one thing, it would be empathy. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like that you would share a similar message, that the emphasis on empathy and on really having a sense of what the people you're trying to take care of are going through, and have some real feel for that, and make sure that's reflected in the products you're making.
I think it's really important. I also think really identifying what we used to call therapeutic target in drug discovery, identify and really deeply understand the problem. Don't just get it out of the New York Times. And I know that this isn't really happening now, but earlier in the field, maybe even 3 years ago,
in the dark days,
I really wanted to,
it
was so important that we get people to the table and meet up of the minds of the people who are experiencing the problems and the people who are outside of the problems but trying to solve them.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Aina. This has been terrific. It's been wonderful to be with you, as always, and really appreciate your taking the time to be on our podcast today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be with you, and I think we bring all our life's lessons to the table, and my experiences personally have driven me further along of wanting to create more care for more better care for more people at
lower
costs.
And you're really doing it.
And also incentivize me to build things like the virtual tumor board so people don't have to run around the country and mm-hmm. can get that level of care. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.